Mitchell Prothero has written a piece for a website called Vice.com about an experience he had as a reporter in the Middle East. He's covered a large part of the Middle East through the years. And in his years in Lebanon, he has tried to get to know members of Hezbollah. Hezbollah is, well, I call them effectively the street gang that runs Lebanon. But they're very tough to know on a personal basis because, after all, they are terrorists and they don't really want the world to know, A, their names, and B, their tactics. Their tactics can lead to a lot of deaths and certainly a lot of hatred of the nation of Israel. But Mitch wanted to learn more about them, and so he went to Hezbollah and suggested, let's have a bunch of us get together and, oh, I don't know, play paintball. I'll get a bunch of journalists together from the West. You get a bunch of Hezbollah guys. We'll go into one of these paintball arenas, and we'll see how it goes. Surprisingly, Hezbollah agreed. And he has written about this experience in a piece on the website Vice.com. When I read it, I said, I've got to talk to this guy about it. So Mitch joins us now, not from Lebanon, but from Kurdistan, which is in the northern part of Iraq. Mitch, are you there?
Yes, I am. Can you guys hear me?
Yeah, we've got you, and I'm glad we have a good connection here today. Have I laid out the basics of this, and can you take it to why you thought paintballing with Hezbollah would be an interesting story?
Well, originally it came about, and you got the broad brush right, but what made it kind of interesting was I knew that there was no way that the press office for Hezbollah, and keep in mind that they're an established political party. They have a large, obviously, military presence, but they have an even larger political and social presence all throughout Lebanon. But one thing that they've never done is really given access to the military wing to Western journalists. They simply never agree to let you interview them, talk to them in any kind of official or unofficial capacity. So this was very frustrating for me because, obviously, they're a very big story and they're a very big part of the of public and political life in Lebanon. So I thought maybe I could convince some of their guys to do it without telling their bosses. And in order to do that, I had to come up with something that they might find fun. So I grabbed a buddy of mine who'd been a ranger in the U.S. Army. He'd been a platoon commander for Joint Special Operations Command and had done three tours in Iraq and Afghanistan. He'd since retired and had become an academic and was doing his PhD on Hezbollah, and I sort of put him up as bait as a chance for them to shoot at him with paintballs. And inexplicably, they agreed. At least some of the guys did. I mean, it had no official, you know, endorsement. I think the press office has already denied that it happened, which, as far as they're concerned, it did, because no one asked them if it was okay. But, you know, a couple of their guys did come out for an evening, as one as the commander who arranged it for me said, he thought it was a nice change of atmosphere.
Now, the Army Ranger who you're talking about is Andrew Exum, who has become a counterinsurgency expert. Did you bring him in because he was, as you call him, the bait, or because you wanted a really good strategist if you ever had to go in there and do paintball battle?
It was a combination of two. I mean, the biggest reason why I invited Exum to come along, it was, in fact, he and I sort of thought it up. I had the idea on the way to meet him for the first time. Like, what are we going to talk about? You know, I'm a longstanding Middle Eastern correspondent, Iraq, Afghanistan, Gaza, Lebanon. This is a guy who's been in the U.S. military. He's doing a PhD on Hezbollah and other insurgent groups in the Middle East. You know, what can I bring to this drink that we're about to have? And I thought, well, I'll just see if he wants to play paintball against some of the guys I know. But then, within seconds of him agreeing to do it rather enthusiastically and probably at the end of his career long term, you know, we also concluded that this would be a complete waste of time if we didn't try to win.
Okay, so take me into the arena, and here you are. You're four journalists, and you've got, you know, Andrew Exum there, who has a lot of military experience and strategic experience, but four Western journalists, who I'm going to guess, of all the people in the arena that night, were the softest guys in the room. What were the Hezbollah fighters like once you got in there? And, I mean, is there such a thing as setting rules for paintball with Hezbollah?
There is. Now, don't sell us too short, though. Yes, we are sort of pasty middle-aged journalists. I think our oldest member was 44 and our youngest 28. But, you know, all of us had experienced varying degrees of pretty serious combat exposure over the last 10 years. You know, Nicholas Blanford is the Times of London correspondent for Beirut. He's covered just about everything that's ever happened in Lebanon and a quite bit of Iraq over 17 years. I've spent countless hours riding in Humvees, getting shot at, or even riding in taxis occasionally getting shot at. So we had some pretty good experience, but yeah, we've never had the experience of actually fighting. Usually as a journalist, or as they like to call it, war correspondent, your biggest job is to stay the heck out of the way of people. So, you know, that was a slight change of mentality for us. Our biggest concern at the beginning of the game, and this was something that had kept me up at night for weeks, was worrying that actual fighters were going to show up. Lots of people run around Beirut saying that they're supporters of the resistance or that they're somehow affiliated, but it's a secret organization on some level, and while they certainly wear military equipment and uniforms while they're in, you know, combat operations, they don't walk around with, you know, ranks and insignias and name tags. So we were a little worried that maybe just some guys were going to show up. When they did come in, I thought this was brilliant. Exum described it as the tension you get right before a rugby match when two groups of players who are about to pummel each other sort of look at each other suspiciously and warily. Throw in some cultural and language concerns, it was very much like that. But I will say when they came in, we were pretty confident that this was the real deal. They had the look. They certainly had a good amount of military training became apparent. And they did not want us to really talk to them at first too much socially or never allowed themselves to be photographed except when wearing their masks. So, you know, that was a good sign. I think just a normal guy off the street wouldn't care about being photographed while he was claiming to be something he wasn't. Once we established that, we got sort of right into the game. And once that happened, there was some confusion over the rules early on. They definitely brazenly cheated through the first couple. I won't lie. We did a little bit of cheating ourselves. We were very intent on winning. But once the games had sort of gone the first couple of rounds, we sat down and established exactly how it was going to be. And, you know, I think everybody showed a pretty good amount of sportsmanship for the rest of the time.
You normally live in Beirut, Lebanon. You've been there for years. You've got a girlfriend who is Lebanese. So you're probably fairly familiar with Hezbollah. Were they ever part of your daily life, or are they a regular presence in the neighborhood that you live in?
Not where I live. Beirut is fairly sectarian in nature. And I don't mean that disparagingly, but while there are mixed neighborhoods all throughout the city, and Lebanon does celebrate its religious diversity, I think they've got 18 different ethnic and religious groups in a country of 4 million, you know, in a lot of cases, different groups sort of tend to stick together. And I don't live in a predominantly Shiite Muslim neighborhood right now. But having said that, yes, they are a ubiquitous presence, particularly in the neighborhoods that are supporters of theirs, but also throughout the city, you'll see signs. They have 11 members of parliament. I think they're the second largest employer in the country beyond the government. You know, they're a huge part of the fabric of the lives of at least a quarter of the Lebanese people.
Yep. I mentioned them in the introduction. I referred to them as a street gang. And I meant that in the same way that in many poor parts of the United States, street gangs provide a function in that they offer social services. They help people out who need, you know, whether it's quote protection unquote, or just help in getting somebody to a doctor or providing other services for them that people can't find through the regular grid work of society. Street gangs can do that, just as years ago the mafia used to do that in neighborhoods that they controlled in the United States. The difference is, as you pointed out, Hezbollah has risen beyond street gang status to actually having national status and a role in the country's military. But when you were doing this paintballing saga, you were dealing with the military side of it. And so let's go back inside that arena and talk again about when you were fighting with these guys. By the way, did they show up with actual military hardware? I mean, you're ready to play with paintball guns. Are they coming with real guns?
No, not at all. In fact, okay, well, yes and no. One thing is, you know, compared to, you know, I would dispute the street gang description a little bit. They're an incredibly well-trained, very disciplined, very focused group of people. they also have, you know, credibility within the Lebanese population. The Lebanese government's very, very weak. They've got a very weak military, and South Lebanon was occupied by Israel for over 25 years. So it's been accepted that a so-called private group was going to, you know, sort of organically sprang up in order to resist that occupation and liberate their lands. That's basically how they formed. Now, what their role today is, that's where it gets a little bit murky, and I'm not sure that the group completely knows where they're going to go going forward, or if they do, they don't fully explain it. But as a result, they don't walk around with guns. In fact, you very, very rarely see a Hezbollah guy with a gun compared to anywhere else I've ever been. But I will say this, is they did show up with a non-lethal flashbang grenade, which is used in hostage situations, and threw that at us in the second game, and we didn't anticipate that.
Well, why would you in a paintball setting?
Well, I joked that we should have, because if you want to get kind of geeky from a military history standpoint, one of the things that the group's noted for in terms of military tactics is sort of unorthodox application of orthodox weapons. They've become very good at turning what other countries have discarded as a piece of equipment for being too simple and sort of flipped it around and figured out a way to completely frustrate the Israelis with it. So on some level, we weren't thinking outside the box enough about what they might do. But we also didn't expect them to take it as seriously as they did.
Were you breaking any U.S. laws by dealing with Hezbollah in this way?
Well, no. You know, I'm a journalist, and I'm allowed, you know, under the First Amendment to go out and, you know, interview, discuss, talk to, and interact with groups, even if they are what they call a specially designated terrorist organization, which Hezbollah certainly is considered such by the U.S. government. I did not engage in any financial transactions with them, which is where the law sort of goes into place. I couldn't have paid them to come. You know, I couldn't have paid their taxis or however they got there, which to this day, I'm not even sure if I know how they got there. So, it was all straightforward stuff. And they knew going in that we were journalists. They did know we were offering up a U.S. Army veteran to shoot at. But, you know, they also knew that I was going to write a story about it. But, you know, they just thought it would be kind of a fun night.
I don't want to reveal the outcome of the paintball battle because I really do want people to read your piece and get inside that arena with you, because you go into what was going through your mind and their minds and the strategy changes that you had to make, and it's fascinating. And I'll put a link to all of that on my website, harrisonline.com, and also on the radio station's website, ktrs.com. But if the goal here, Mitch, was to get to know these guys, was the mission accomplished?
Absolutely. Beyond my wildest expectations. Anybody who's played serious sports or even, you know, sort of been to war, even if it's a quasi, you know, non-lethal one, you get to know people pretty quickly, and it allows you to sort of judge character. And what I realized in dealing with them was that these guys, you know, as I would say, wars are fought by human beings. I've been accused of making them look human in the piece, which, you know, is my job. I don't think for a minute I've been to enough of them now that, you know, every conflict that's ever been fought has been fought by, you know, generally young men and very human young men. They die as humans and they live as humans. So, you know, I was sort of glad in a way to hear that criticism. Having said that, I think they also realized that we were taking it seriously, that we were, you know, pretty good guys, and that we weren't going to come in with preconceived notions about them as being terrorists or whatnot, but rather we're just going to see them as human beings that we were competing against. And I think they really appreciated that, because I know the U.S. government's designated them as such, and certainly the Israelis hate them. You know, these guys don't think they're terrorists. They think that they are patriots. They think they're defending their land and their, you know, to a certain extent, their religion. And that if they weren't there, that the people of South Lebanon would still be occupied in their view and, you know, definitely, as they'd say, enslaved. So whether you think that's fair or not, you know, I'm not going to speak to that, but it's what these guys think. So they don't think of themselves in any kind of nasty way. And to see us treating them like young men, I think they appreciated that.
Do they, to a man, hate Israel?
Yes, absolutely. You know, they have fought them. Every one of the guys that we were in the room with at one time or another has fought against the Israelis. I'll point out, on Lebanese land, when they did it, I don't think any of them have ever done an operation inside Israel, and I'm not sure that Hezbollah's actually ever done an operation inside Israel. But how do I put this? It's a nasty little regional war. It's over longstanding political concerns. It's to a certain extent, from the Lebanese view, it's over control of water, which is in small supply in northern Israel, Palestine, and southern Lebanon, has quite a bit of. So they see it as theft of their natural resources. And many of them have had friends killed. They've signed up to fight Israel. So, yeah, they do. But even as the boss told me, he doesn't hate them. He just considers them his enemy that he quite respects on many levels. He pointed out he respects them more than he respects the Saudis, because at least the Israelis do their own work and fight for themselves, whereas he was quite dismissive of Saudi Arabian culture. And he even respects them on some level more than he respects the Palestinians, because I think he felt as though the Palestinians have always had difficulty really identifying what their goals are and standing up and fighting, much like the Lebanese of South Lebanon are very proud of the fact that not only did they resist an occupation, but they won it.
By extension, do they hate America or American policies because we support Israel?
Well, they certainly do not like American policies towards, in support of Israel. No, they don't hate America. They are not confused, but I think they would be critical of American foreign policy. I think that this is what guys have expressed to me. People are more than able to go out and learn because these guys have talked about it directly themselves. So I don't want to get in a position where I'm, defining the group for them. They're more than capable. But my personal view is nobody in these areas really hates Americans. They're just a little baffled why, the land of the free and the home of the brave. And they've heard all the same things. They've seen all the cowboy movies. They certainly, in many cases, I think their leaders have read the Constitution and quite like the American system. Are a little baffled why, in their mind, America has wholeheartedly taken the side of somebody that they feel perpetrates injustice on their land, or at least did prior to the withdrawal in 2000. So that's one element. The second element is, yes, on some level they do see themselves as in conflict with American foreign policy goals in the region. So, there's been rumors that Hezbollah guys have popped up in Iraq, helping the Iranians sort of stir the pot to keep America busy in that occupation. As a group, they deny it and say, no, we only fight in South Lebanon. But I think there's probably some veracity to if their allies in Iran say, hey, we need a couple of guys who are good fighters who speak Arabic to come in and train some Iraqis. It wouldn't surprise me terribly if they had done that.
Well, that leads
see themselves in sort of low-intensity competition with America's policies or what they see as an agenda.
That leads directly to the next thing I was going to ask you, which is to take an even broader step back and ask, Hezbollah supposedly gets funding from Iran. You probably would take the word supposedly out of that sentence. I don't know. But
the head of Hezbollah would take it out of that sentence. He's flat out admitted that they are funded by the Iranian government and a group of religious charities there in Iran. So
okay.
that's without dispute.
So if they're part of that axis of evil, if we can resurrect that phrase for just a moment, do they pose a threat to the United States of America? Or, as you say, they say, no, we're really just concerned with what's going on here in our own country, in our own region?
I mean, it depends on what you mean. Will Hezbollah ever conduct a attack of some kind on American soil? I would go out on a limb and say absolutely not. I suppose things could shift over time where some kind of broader regional conflict breaks out, and I might back off that. But I have an incredibly difficult time seeing how they would, one, think that was a good idea, and two, properly motivate and explain that to their own group. One of the things that makes them such a strong organization in the Arab world is that they make sure that they only pursue things that sort of all their people are on board with. So the more they can keep it to, we defend southern Lebanon from Israel, it'd be easier it is politically. It would be much more difficult for them to explain an attack in New York City or San Francisco. Secondly, they do quite a bit of fundraising on their own through the extensive Lebanese Shia diaspora in the United States, South America, and everywhere. And they rely on these people for support. And I think that, you know, there's quite a, there's people in the United States who support the goals of Hezbollah, but would become increasingly uncomfortable with the group if they felt like they were sending suicide bombers into Manhattan. It's just not on their agenda. It's not something that I even think they would consider religiously acceptable. They're not Al-Qaeda. But in terms of American foreign policy, yeah, I do think that they see that as being done, you know, part and parcel with Israeli goals, and that they might take steps to sort of screw with that a little bit, particularly as things heat up with Iran over the Iranian nuclear program. They're completely clear that they are close, if not completely together, allies with the Iranian government and the Iranian military. And so they haven't said that they would retaliate for a strike on the nuclear program, but most of us think there's a very, very good possibility that they would.
All right, let's go back.
I like to joke, Iran didn't give them $1 billion not to attack Israel if Israel attacks Iran.
Right. Let's go back to the paintball arena for just a second, because here you are, you and three Western journalists and a former Army Ranger, and you're going to do battle against four or five guys who are actual fighters for Hezbollah. I'm curious how that went over with the guy who runs this paintball arena in this strip mall in Beirut.
It took those guys, they were Lebanese, and obviously, and one of the rules we had going in, I'd been given sort of a list of rules that the guys that were coming to play had requested, and one of them was no Lebanese present, because they can sort of categorize Western journalists as maybe unsympathetic, could be spies, but we think we know what you are. Whereas if they just randomly encounter somebody from Lebanon who speaks Arabic, and you know, they're not going to be sure who this guy is. And keep in mind, after a 20-year occupation, you know, the Israelis have numerous Lebanese who've worked for them, at least in the past, and probably continue today. I think the Lebanese government's arrested about 200 people for spying for Israel in the last 3 years. So these guys, when they came in, the guys who ran the place suddenly knew what was going on, and they were a little bit intimidated. We had to yell at them a little bit in terms of the referees sort of calling fouls, because they weren't really willing to call fouls on the Hezbollah guys in the early stages.
Really?
Of the match. Yeah, they were a little intimidated. And I have to say the deployment of the flashbang grenade definitely got their attention.
I'm just trying to picture this going on.
At least as much as it got mine.
I'm just trying to picture this going on in some American paintball arena with some kid who's working for minimum wage, and all of a sudden there's a flashbang grenade, and he goes, you know what, I'll just be in the back if you need me.
That's pretty much what happened. By the end, it had settled into sort of a proper setup, and they grew increasingly more comfortable and confident, but you know, I doubt any of them had ever really talked with somebody who was clearly, you know, as they'd say, a member of the resistance. And, you know, the guys weren't walking around describing themselves as such, but it's pretty obvious when you see two rather fit men running in perfect formation across a paintball arena, peppering, you know, other opponents with well-placed shots at a dead run, completely fearless of being hit themselves.
Yeah.
It's pretty obvious they've got significant military training.
All right, the last thing I've got to ask you about, Mitch, is your girlfriend, Soha. You write about her in the piece. You mentioned that she served as your translator and kind of a liaison. But I'm curious what the reaction was of all of these guys, young guys, who are members of Hezbollah and are Lebanese themselves. And here is a Lebanese woman who is hanging around with her Western boyfriend. Were there tensions over that? Was her role there difficult?
She's quite adept at dealing with these situations. I think partially by having a Western boyfriend who does spend quite a bit of time around these sorts. She's picked up a few things, but she's also from a pretty tough neighborhood in northern Lebanon in her own right. So that's one thing. Two, her name is ambiguous. So she very well could have been a Christian. a Druze or a Muslim, and it probably wouldn't have bothered them all that much if she had been a Christian. You know, they tend not to care quite, and maybe a little bit of nationalism in that regard. But when they realized that she was a Muslim from northern Lebanon, a Sunni, not a Shia, not from their sect, but a Muslim nonetheless, she was dating the Westerner that had dared challenge them to the match. This did spark quite a bit of trash talking and did seem to make me a bit of a paintball magnet there for a couple of rounds. But it was definitely good-natured as well. You know, they did seem to approve, and since then, actually, the boss and a couple of these guys have seen her around and even given her rides before, and they definitely are a little bit befuddled that this could be going on, but they seem to respect our relationship.
Well, Mitch, it's a remarkable story. I'm so glad we were able to get past the incredibly difficult complexities of the international telephone system to get you on here to share it. I'm going to put a link up on harrisonline.com and on the Steve Cochran page on KTRS.com so that our listeners can go in and read the entire story. I'm really glad you could share a piece of it with us here today, and congratulations on that and on your years of work as a journalist covering what most people would have to agree is the toughest region in the world.
Yeah, thank you very much. It was nice to do something, even though the, you know, the situation could be described as political or even, you know, related to these things. It was sort of nice to do a story that didn't really involve anybody getting killed for once.
Yeah.
So it was a nice change for me.
Thank you so much, Mitch. I appreciate it.
Cheers. Thank you very much.
Mitchell Prothero, the guy who put this together and writes about it in a piece on Vice.com called Paintballing with Hezbollah. I'm Paul Harris. This is the Steve Cochran Show on the Big 550 KTRS.